Hello, and welcome to episode 39 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zout. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Rachel Ankeny, professor at the University of Adelaide in Adelaide, Australia. Rachel's research interests cross several areas and fields: the history and philosophy of science, particularly biomedical biological sciences, bioethics and science policy, food studies, and migration history. In the history and philosophy of science, her research focuses on the roles of models and case-based reasoning in science, model organisms, the philosophy of medicine, and the history of contemporary life sciences. Her research in bioethics examines ethical and policy issues in genetics, reproduction, women's health, transplantation, and embryo and stem cell research, among other topics. She also has expertise and ongoing research on health and science policy, particularly regarding public engagement. In food studies, Rachel's research interests include food ethics, food habits of women and children, food habits in the Italian diaspora, and the relationship of science to food habits. Rachel is currently the lead investigator on an Australian Research Council Linkage Project grant entitled Hostile Stories Toward a Richer Narrative of the Lived Experiences of Migrants, in collaboration with the Migration Museum and in partnership with the cities of Charles Sturt and Port Adelaide Enfield State Records and the Vietnamese community in Australia. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Rachel. Dr. Rachel Ankeny, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
I'm great. Thank you for inviting me on.
And I'm calling your office, or you're sitting in Pittsburgh. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm over for a research visit with one of my collaborators.
Fantastic. How's the visit going so far?
It's going great. And I'm here also. We're running a workshop for Jim Lennox, who was my supervisor, who's retiring. So it's a nice time to be back in Pittsburgh.
He was your supervisor. Okay. Did you study under him in graduate school?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. In graduate school. So I did my PhD here at Pitt in history and philosophy of science.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, excited to learn about that. And yeah, so I've heard when I was there earlier in the summer, in the spring, that this is called Lennox Fest or something like that, I guess.
Yeah. had the tradition of running so-and-so fests when people retire.
Like last year was Ken Fest for Kenneth Schaffner, and now this year is Lennox Fest.
That's right.
Which I think is a really great opportunity, right, to celebrate a life and bring, I imagine, scholars and others who have either written about their work or have been directly supervised, I imagine, for his work.
Yeah, well, and it's quite diverse because his lines of research, as you might know, really cross, between ancient philosophy, Darwin, philosophy of biology, some philosophy of medicine. So it's quite a diverse program, and it's fantastic people coming from all over the world, really, to be part of it.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you enjoy your time there, and I'm looking to hear of, I wish I could be there. Unfortunately, I don't think I'll be able to make it. Colin was suggesting I come out for it, but it looks like it won't be able to, but hope it's a good time, and hope you enjoy it.
Thanks.
Well, let's get started, and I'd love to learn more about you, and why don't we go ahead and start back at the beginning, Rachel. Well, maybe to introduce our guest as well, you're currently a professor at the University of Adelaide, is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's in Western Australia?
No, Southern Australia.
Completely
geography.
And there are
a million people there. It's not a small town.
Yeah.
But it is a bit tricky for people. Yeah, it's not, it doesn't come first to mind when people think of Australia. But yeah, down in Southern Australia, I sit in a school of humanities, which lets me cross between both philosophy and history. And I'm the associate dean of research and the deputy dean in the Faculty of Arts as well.
Wow, fantastic. So how long have you been there in Australia?
So I moved to Australia in 2000. At first, I was the director and a lecturer, senior lecturer later, of the History and Philosophy of Science unit at the University of Sydney. And then I moved down to Adelaide about 10 years later. So I've been about 10 years in each location.
Great, great. Well, I'm excited to hear more and what philosophy of science is like in Australia, too. I'm very interested to hear more about that. But yeah, let's take a step back and let me ask, Rachel, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit. I was born in Detroit and then grew up just outside of Detroit once the riots in Detroit became interesting in the late 1960s. So my family then moved to Dearborn, which is Ford Motor Company kind of land. And basically, you know, very blue collar type setting, very multicultural. But yeah, and I spent through my high school years there.
Oh, okay. What did both your parents do? Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Sorry. Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, no, I was just, you know, growing up, what did mom and dad do?
Dad was a journalist who was sort of trained on the job or trained in the military, then on the job. My mom was a school teacher, sort of alternative students, and she had sort of the equivalent of a PhD degree, but had sort of done it piecemeal over quite a long periods of time. And was raised in a big, very Italian family, but in a Middle Eastern community. That part of Detroit is heavily Middle Eastern. So it was a very diverse kind of upbringing. High school was, you know, a fairly average kind of Midwest high school. You just sort of did the classic topics. At that point in time, I thought that I wanted to be a genetic counselor or perhaps a clinician with specialization in genetic medicine. And so kind of shaped my high school years to go towards that kind of degree eventually. So I did a lot of work in genetic counseling as a high school student.
Really?
Yeah, and I also managed sort of ended up being an office manager for a durable medical goods company because I ran out of classes to take in high school. So got a part-time job and simply started earning money. So the useful thing is I learned to type because that's proven incredibly useful as an academic.
Right, right. So how did the genetic counseling come to be?
I don't know. I just had always been interested in that. I was interested both sort of in the counseling itself and in the ethical issues. Volunteered somewhere and then ended up picking up work on some grants. You know, this is back in the old days. I'm older than I look. So back in the days before, you know, there was a lot of genetic testing available. We were doing chromosome-based kind of work. And so we'd go out and collect blood samples and try and give people advice in communities where there was certain kinds of diseases. So study of Fragile X, for example. So it was kind of a turning point, but it would have been, you know, the early 80s when there wasn't a lot available except a bit of advice and a bit of very, very basic knowledge of genetics. So it was interesting work, but I think.
And this was by the end. But this was in high school, correct? So this was like a part-time job, or was it something that just?
Yeah, in summers and then into college. I did it even when I was in college, sort of in the summers, because sort of kept up my interest in that area. But when I went to college, I kind of didn't really know what I wanted to do. We didn't get a lot of advice about how to pick a college.
Sure.
And so basically I looked at options that were very local and had a good option, a nice scholarship to go to University of Michigan, which was a local school, obviously. And when I went to look around, it had absolutely huge classes, particularly for science and math. And I had an interest in science and math. Obviously, I thought I wanted to go into medicine, so I really wanted to do a lot of science subjects. The rest of my subjects would have been in an honors college. So those would have been smaller kinds of, even within the college, residential kind of setting. But I didn't like the balance. So I didn't particularly like the idea of these huge classes where I thought I get lost in the mix and I might well just kind of go back to things that were more comfortable because of the size of the classes. So then I started looking around for the smallest school I could find in the country, basically. And I hit on St. John's College, which has campuses in Annapolis, Maryland, and Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay.
And wasn't really probably as familiar with the curriculum as I should have been. So it's one of the great book schools where it's all primary sources. But ended up basically getting in there, wanting to go east, but they were full, so I went west instead. Made my parents happy because I had some relatives out there, and I was young. I was only 17, and ended up there. And lucky for me, it was a really good fit because I don't think I really fully appreciated what I was getting myself into. But it was good. It was very, very good for me because my high school education had been okay, but not fantastic, and so it allowed me, in a sense, to back to basics kind of thing and not have to choose any majors or any subjects. St. John's, everything is a required curriculum focused on the primary. So, you know, I did 4 years of basically philosophy, literature, math, science, a couple years of music, a couple years of French, a couple years of ancient Greek, you know, so it sort of allowed that well-rounded kind of liberal arts education.
And you're saying there's two, they have two locations. There's one in, one in New Mexico, one on the East Coast, one in New Mexico.
Yeah, and I was in New Mexico for 4 years. And there's lots of people in our field, history and philosophy of science in particular, but philosophy of science, who go through St. John's. It just seems to be, I don't know, the cart and the horse, but because HPS is so sort of interdisciplinary, a lot of people who go there end up in HPS is probably the best way to put it, but there's a lot of flow between, And
so was that your first experience into philosophy of science? Was it at St. John's or was it?
No, not really, because it's a primary text sort of thing. So we wouldn't have read any philosophy of science because, you know, well, anything that would have been labeled philosophy of science. Certainly we read lots of primary texts on science and we read lots of philosophy. You know, we read Aristotle and a lot of things that would ride kind of in that space in between. So no, St. John's is sort of notorious for not really having those secondary or meta level concepts. So I also didn't do any history as such because that wasn't what we were taught. We learned primary sources and we wouldn't have learned historiography or even kind of secondary perspectives. So when I was done from there, I won a scholarship for a year from the Watson Foundation, which is the scholarships are sort of designed to allow people a year to just explore their interests. And my proposal was focused on genetic testing and Huntington's disease. And so I traveled and sort of you just do independent study. So I traveled and worked in a variety of settings where people with Huntington's disease were seen. So primarily genetic counseling, but also through some of the support groups and did that in Europe for about 3 or 4 months and found it incredibly depressing and bailed out of that and basically traveled to Greece and pursued some other interests with the blessing of the foundation because I just simply, you know, I was meeting a lot of people who were dying or whose families were watching them die, people my age who'd been diagnosed, you know, with the gene, but there's absolutely nothing to be done about it. And it was just, it was quite difficult going. So kind of changed it up and did some other things and came back to the States and worked in publishing, and also I worked for Mortimer Adler, who was sort of a public philosopher back in the day, and in Chicago, and he ran an office that was a combination of part of Encyclopedia Britannica, part of a great books program for public schools, so what was called the Padea program. So did some teaching of great books in primary and high schools. Did editing, particularly of a series from Britannica that was associated with the great books. And I did that for a couple of years and started to get ready to think about graduate school at that point. I'd sort of abandoned medical school a long time before that, medical and law school, and decided what I want to do is what I thought of as philosophy, which then people convinced me was something called history and philosophy of science. So I was lucky because I had a fantastic boss at the time, a man called John Van Doren, who was the son of Mark Van Doren, who was the poet laureate for the States and whatever. And we had fantastic contributors. So I remember when I was getting ready to go, you know, to think about graduate school, he said, oh, just call up some of the people, you know. And so I used my Rolodex because we had Rolodexes back in the day. And, you know, he said, oh, you should try. And so we went through and found some people. And I remember contacting completely odd cast of characters in retrospect, but Stephen Toulmin and Evelyn Fox Keller and a tutor professor at St. John's called Curtis Wilson, who was a sort of historian of physics. You know, that's what we would call him now. But anyway, so I contacted them and sort of said, here's what I'm thinking I want to do. I want to do study science, but through primary texts. And I also at that point wanted to do bioethics. So I had translated the genetic counseling into bioethics. And they gave me advice on sort of where to go to school and that there was this field called history and philosophy of science. And they all pointed me in similar directions. And then at the end of the day, it boiled down to Pitt, which at that time had programs obviously in philosophy, history and philosophy of science, and also bioethics. And so I came to Pitt.
Wow. It's quite the story. So so you mentioned something about how I learned to do philosophy, which I now realize before, which of what I thought of philosophy. How did you at the time distinguish HPS from maybe more traditional analytic philosophy?
Oh, well, that's a slightly different question. So what I was referring to was doing primary text analysis of philosophical text, so history of ideas, we might even call it today.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay.
Or ancient philosophy from doing philosophy of science, which was sort of the next level removed, so reflecting on science. But I think you're absolutely right, and it goes to sort of another set of issues about where the field is heading. I do think analytic philosophy of science, which is the bulk of what we engaged with, particularly in a program like Pitt, is very different than, say, an integrated HPS of today.
Yeah.
These things come and go and change. But I would say what I do today is a much more integrated, historical, philosophical, probably even borrowing sociological techniques, and approaching the sciences kind of as they're given, rather than hardcore analytic philosophy of science, which, often doesn't necessarily engage with scientific practice. So certainly in my work today, I really focus on looking at actual practices in all different forms, and then, letting the science in many ways guide me. It may well be that then I come back to a fairly theoretical kind of exploration or conceptual exploration of what I'm observing or what I'm reading or whatever else. But at the end of the day, it's a very practice-driven endeavor.
Yeah.
And that's also been influenced by several friends of mine, and I founded a society, about 10 years ago now, a little more than 10 years ago, the Society for Philosophy of Science and Practice. Yeah, which when we founded it, we thought very few people would be interested, and it's really caught fire, which is absolutely fantastic. And so very pleased that that's come to be what it is and come to be a very different kind of venue. The irony is, in many ways now, there's lots of venues that are open to science and practice, that are open to interdisciplinary explorations. But certainly when we started it, say, 12 years ago, we were feeling as though, or 14 years ago, depending how you think about it, that there wasn't a place to go to a conference where you could do work that was interdisciplinary but very much focused on scientific practice. We were looking to kind of have an alternative kind of location for that sort of work, not to be a competitor to anything that existed, but, to open up that alternative. And obviously a lot of people feel the same way, because now it's quite a vibrant group and a very active biennial conference. So that's been a real, real pleasure to see that take root.
Yeah. I'm interested. I didn't realize you were part of the sort of the forming committee or really exciting.
That was great. So Hasek Chang, who's at Cambridge now, and then a cluster of our colleagues from the Netherlands. It kind of spun off a conference that had occurred in the Netherlands, hosted by Henk Dirac, who was also one of the people, and then Mieke Boon, who's a philosopher of technology engineering, and Marcel Bauwens, who's a philosopher of economics. Oh. So all of us came together and started SPSP. And it's now hopefully in new and vibrant hands. I'm just finishing up my time on the organizing committee. But it's been fantastic. And I think particularly for graduate students and early career folks, it's been a great opportunity to do work that's really quite different and have an open forum at which to share that.
Yeah, okay. Well, so before we get to the formation of that, as studying at Pitt, you said there was more hardcore analytic philosophy of science. I mean, what kind of work were you doing there in your doctorate work?
So my doctorate work, fairly traditional, heavy coursework the first few years, but I did a mixture of, I got a master's in philosophy, so I did quite a lot in the philosophy department as well, and then also did a degree in, at the time it was called medical ethics, but a bioethics degree as well, which involved, everything from practical experiences to classroom kind of work. My dissertation itself, then for the PhD, was a blended history but also conceptual look at the use of the nematode C. elegans and this idea of a model organism. So examining how it was that the researchers who work with this organism came to invest in it in order to give it the status that it came to have. That would have been in the late 1990s, so it was sort of in the height of the Human Genome Project, but also the associated non-human organism kind of work. And so that was, quite a blended kind of investigation of that research group, but the very idea of a model organism. And that kind of idea of a model organism has really shaped a lot of my work in philosophy since that time.
So in terms of your findings with C. elegans, what did you find that perhaps was surprising or unique to your work?
I think, you know, things that aren't surprising to us today. And so, in fact, we're running a whole workshop next week at Cold Spring Harbor around this idea of model organisms and the history. But back then, I think C. elegans is often seen as a real success story, certainly within the biological community, you know, sort of taking something out of obscurity and making it into the experimental organism it is today. But, of course, as with any historical story, you know, the details are more complex than that. Yeah. So it was very much, there's a lot of serendipity, a lot of personalities that really played into the ability to make it into what it was. And then on the philosophical side, I think there hadn't been adequate attention up till that point about this notion of using an organism as a model. And so really hit hard that idea, both, I would say, conceptually, but also kind of the history that shaped the very idea of a model organism, which was closely tied into the genome projects. So as much as today that's just very intuitive to us, certainly right. even you know in the late 1990s, the terminology was being used without much reflection on what was at stake, how you knew when something was likely to work or not likely to work, and where this might be headed. And so that those were a lot of the sorts of questions that I started to ask at that time.
Very interesting. And in connection with your interest in medical and bioethics, did this work overlap, or was there any, did you, you know, do ethics related to model organisms, or was this, were you addressing other questions?
No, not so much. I mean, my master's in bioethics focused on transplantation, and I was actually employed here at the medical center as a transplant ethicist for a number of years while I was finishing my PhD. So I sort of had two parallel tracks running. Yeah. I mean, I would say there clearly are questions of science policy that came into the C. elegans right. dissertation and subsequent, you know, about why give funding and how do you know what's going to be a good bet in terms of funding structures and other sort of science policy kinds of questions. There also were questions that arose that overlapped kind of in the domain of what I would now call philosophy of medicine. So as far as, you know, what is genetic disease? What can we expect to learn from model organisms for genetic disease? And so on, that go back to my longstanding interests that I've already mentioned. Right. And so I published on those sorts of questions fairly soon after my PhD. But the dissertation as such was pretty firmly HPS kind of content, perhaps with a bit of sociology tinge without having a lot of experience with sociological methods at that point.
What kind of sociology did you do?
Well, a lot of a lot of interviews, a lot of participant observation right. kinds of things, right?
Cool, cool.
And that was a little more unusual, you know, back then. I remember, doing oral histories was even controversial in history, as far as what can you get out of an oral history and so on. Let alone a little bit unusual in HPS. Some people were doing it, but my actors were all basically alive, so I did a lot of that with support from NSF, which was nice.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah, their dissertation scholarships back in the day. Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
So, all right. So, and upon successfully completing your PhD, what came next? Were you, was it straight to academia? Were you following the HPS track or the bioethics track or both?
No, I got a job here at Pitt, actually. I got a tenure track job at Pittsburgh.
Wow.
At that point in time, Ken Schaffner had been on leave for quite a long time and then gave notice that he was not coming back. And they'd been searching for several years and not able to find somebody who kind of fit the space between who's able to do both bioethics and philosophy of medicine and biology job description. And so I applied and got that job. And all I can say is probably not great to work where you went to school. So for
right.
various reasons.
How was that experience?
not very good, to be frank.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
They all know that I think this. Primarily because basically as I started, a decision was made to close the bioethics program. So in effect.
Wow.
Or to move it out and not have HPS affiliated with it. So in effect, half of my job sort of became quite uncertain. And even though I was in a tenure track position, that made me very nervous and sort of made me nervous about the future of this position.
Absolutely.
Didn't make me highly comfortable here. And so I decided to look for a job and elsewhere and got a very nice position in a place called Connecticut College, which is a small liberal arts college northeast. And they had a chair in philosophy and science, which really suited me. So that was fantastic. And got that and then moved there. And I taught there. I was there for 2 years, including a fellowship at Princeton in the history department to continue to do, you know, sort of work related to my dissertation.
Yeah.
And then didn't end up going back because at that point I ended up getting a job in Sydney and moving to Sydney.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. So quite
transient. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite transient. But then, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, since then, as you've been in Sydney. Yeah. So, I mean, you're doing both. So what do you say? I mean, even at this time, your work is quite integrated.
Yeah. I mean, my work all along has been really integrated. I mean, I wouldn't have described it as science and practice back then. I don't think that kind of way of thinking about it really didn't come about till, say, well into the 2000s when we started talking that way much more explicitly.
Right.
I always saw it as, you know, doing some history, and then in its own right, it was interesting, the history that I was doing, and also doing very conceptually driven philosophy of science around both biology and medicine. And then having a second track, which was clearly focused on issues in bioethics, particularly reproductive technologies, transplantation, policy in bioethics became a strand. And so I had these balls kind of in the air all along, I would say.
Very nice, very nice. So then how was the transition to Sydney? What went into this decision? And you know, yeah.
This is an honest podcast, right? Time, my partner at the time was already living in Sydney, and I got a bit tired of going back and forth between the countries. And so I've been spending a lot of time. I have relatives in Sydney, and position became available because Paul Griffiths had moved, was moving out, and so I applied for and got that position, which was in effect both an academic position and the director of the unit.
Yeah.
Which was a big move. I mean, to sort of as a equivalent of an assistant professor to sort of step into being a head of department in a very small group, but nonetheless, you still have to do everything that a head has to do in a new country all at once was a fairly big move. But I enjoyed it. We were able to form a nice group in Sydney, and the HPS unit is now actually a school in Sydney, which in Australian terms is a very big deal. We went from me being the only ongoing person or permanent person to having a staff of 4 or 5 by the time I left. Mm-hmm. And now they're even more than that. So it's really wonderful that it's really taken root. And the thing I probably liked most about Sydney was that we were actually in a science faculty. So that really gave us that foot in both in terms of research and collaborations and so on, but also students. So particularly our undergraduate students, often we're coming out of the sciences with rich background in the sciences, and I enjoyed that. It was a nice place to sit.
Your status, or I guess so, the title was science faculty, and then
it was a faculty of science. Yeah, not like here where you would have arts and sciences together. So there was a separate faculty of arts, but that wasn't where philosophy was located and history is located and so on. Sure. And it's still that way to this day. So there's a school of HPS, which is in sciences, and then there are philosophers of science and historians of science who sit over in the Faculty of Arts. Wow. And it does give them, in a sense, more staff if all goes well, because you have sort of multiple departments doing similar things, and they cross over a lot, they collaborate, people are affiliated. It's not competition as such, it just really widens the base for them, which is fantastic.
Great. So what kinds of... what are a couple papers or projects you were working on at the time at Sydney that you were particularly proud of or really enjoyed working on?
Yeah, at Sydney, I would say on the HPS side, I was doing work around looking at neurobiology in particular. And that project's something I think that's kind of really led to a lot of the thinking I'm doing on some current work, even if I didn't necessarily get a lot of papers out of it as such. On the bioethics side, it led me to much more empirically based bioethics. Excuse me. So it led to a lot more bioethics work that wasn't just theoretical or policy driven, but was actually looking at, again, practices. And I think some of the work there, particularly in transplantation, was quite good. And then a broader project where we looked at using deliberative political philosophy to understand policy development in bioethics and using these kind of deliberative methods as a tool in bioethics was probably a pretty important sort of step in my research. And I think it would have been at Sydney that I started to develop a line of research in philosophy of science around cases and the use of cases in not just medicine, but more generally in the sciences. And that's something I've kind of continued to this day.
If you wouldn't mind saying a few thoughts on, your consideration of the usefulness or how to use cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think cases are rather ubiquitous in the sciences. It's just that we don't always see them. Mm-hmm. And so as somebody who thinks a lot about medicine and its practices, cases are inevitable. They're everywhere in medicine. And so I took that sort of starting point to really try to think about what the status is of a case as a form of evidence, or what kind of epistemological work do cases do? That probably is a better way to put the questions that I was interested in.
Right.
And in several kinds of papers, different places, argue that, in fact, they do real epistemological work. I think cases in medicine particularly kind of have a reputation as being, if at best, second best, and certainly not a source of evidence, mm-hmm. tend to focus on individual instances, you know, of things that are a bit either obscure or unusual or whatever else. And I flip that on its head and try and show how cases, in fact, can serve as evidence for certain sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they often can serve as starting points. They can serve as an entry into coming up with broader explanations or theories, and therefore, even though they don't have, say, an elevated status in the hierarchy of evidence for EBM, from medical researchers' points of view, they often do serve these kind of epistemological purposes. And then also looking at the forms that they take. So what is it that gets packaged up into a case that then comes to serve certain roles? What about it is sort of just rhetoric? What about it does have to do with finding causal relations and so on? So trying to get beyond kind of the reputation that cases had was that they're in those parts of medical journals where doctors publish poems and personal experiences, and then there's a case. But there certainly has been a move in recent years particularly, but certainly over the last 10 or 15 years, to legitimate the case again as a form of knowing. And so my work in philosophy of medicine, I would say one of the themes has been looking at that whole nexus, but also starting to look at cases in other sorts of domains.
Great, great. Yeah, we definitely think in terms of medicine, a case is, well, I don't know, is there a distinction to be made between medical cases and then the other kinds of cases that we might, that philosophers of science write about in other sciences?
Well, the cases that philosophers of science write about too often are just tinker toy cases.
Right.
You know, they tend to be things people have made up, to be frank. At worst, you know, and then some. In there, there's a place for thought experiments, but there's no reason to think it's a case of anything.
Right.
Somewhere in the middle, there's kind of cases from the history of science or cases that draw on the history of science. And too often, I think philosophers of science cherry pick, you know, and that's a big accusation that historians would have against philosophers of science. And certainly more practice-oriented people, you know, the details do matter. You can't cherry pick an example just to point something out. Oh, you can. It's just not very good history.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very good philosophy because you're not talking about real biology or real whatever it is that you're using the case for.
Yep. Okay.
In the sciences, I think the answer is much more complex, and there's an overlap certainly between cases that are used, for example, within the social sciences. There's family resemblances between fields, but real differences. In biology, there are ways in which things are used in effect as equivalent to cases that, you know, have some similarity to medicine. Mm-hmm. Medicine is a bit of an extreme because we actually care about individual people. We don't tend to care about individuals, you know, in the same way in biology unless there are pets, you know, and so
sure.
on. And so it's a matrix of kind of complex considerations that go in the way of shaping what goes in a case and even the language that's used around various types of cases. And so, yeah, this is an ongoing interest of mine, together with Mary Morgan, who's at London School of Economics, mm-hmm. Particularly comparing some of my stuff, which is more biomedical, hers, which lies more in the social sciences, and trying to come up with, if not a general account of cases, which I don't think there will be,
sure.
Something that's a more sophisticated look at the way in which there are similarities and differences that are epistemologically interesting between different fields.
Fantastic. So, aside from your work in cases and some of your HPS work, I've noticed that you've taken to an interest in food studies. Is that right?
Yes. So,
tell me about that. Yeah. So, how did
the story
this come
there out? Was? I've always been interested in food, probably because of my Italian background, but just in general, food habits and this sort of thing. In Sydney, when I was a little bit sort of tired and needed something extra to do,
sure.
I did a remote degree. So I did a master's degree in gastronomy or, you know, food culture history. Mm-hmm. So I did another master's because I wanted to get familiar with that literature and also, you know, come to be able to write and understand what was going on there. And I saw it as a way to get kind of up to speed to begin to do work in food studies, but also around ethical issues in food. And so the move to Adelaide was actually to teach in a program associated, a food studies type program. It was called something different at that time. That program since has closed down, but
is this the food values research group or something?
No. So there was a gastronomy. There was a master's in gastronomy program at Adelaide, which was what we call in Australia coursework master's, which was the degree I had done. Mm-hmm. And the person who was running it was getting ready for retirement, knew I was looking to leave Sydney, that I was ready to do something different.
Yeah.
And so I applied and got the job effectively to become the director of that program. Mm-hmm. So I moved down to Adelaide for a long boring story. That program ended up closing down as a master's program, mm-hmm. but I was by then in the history department and affiliated with the philosophy department, and so I stayed on. And Adelaide's a small enough place as a university that many people do very interdisciplinary work. And the idea always was that I would keep doing my bioethics and keep doing my history and philosophy of science side by side with the food studies work. So the food values research group I still run at Adelaide. We've got some postdocs and a number of graduate students doing topics roughly clustered around food and values. And we've got some fairly big grant projects running around different issues in food ethics, including genetic modification, animal welfare, kind of consumer preferences associated with some of those ethical food categories.
Yeah. So what kinds of questions are you interested in? Like what? If there were, one or two things that you're still either you've worked on or that you're still really interested in working on, what would those be?
Yeah, I mean, I do think what I mentioned about kind of cases and how they work, I think there's a lot more I want to do there. Increasingly interested again, and have been publishing a bit more around genetic diseases, and I think it's a good time to come back to that, because as much as a number of things have changed or, kind of been solved in a sense conceptually, I think the relevance of genes to disease and lack of relevance of genes to disease is still a topic that warrants exploration, not just ethically. I actually don't find the ethical bits as interesting anymore, but philosophically, conceptually. So the epistemology even of what gets called a disease and how it gets, medical care gets organized around those kinds of ideas. So more firmly in philosophy of medicine. We've got a big project going at the moment. So Mike Dietrich, me, Sabina Leonelli, with several graduate students around organisms. And so we're looking at non-model organisms, so experimental organisms much more broadly, and really studying biological practice. So it involves lots of interviews and lab observations and so on around how people choose to work with what they work with, but also then how that work occurs and the importance of having organism-centered research. So that involves some really interesting questions about, why do you study what you do? What do you think you're going to learn from it? All the way to what kinds of generalizations can you get out of, using an obscure model to study a particular disease or a particular process or a particular, physiological mechanism.
Could you maybe share? Have you come across, what are some examples of some experimental organisms that might be?
Oh, my new favorites for the week. Let's see. So, had a really wonderful set of interviews with a person who uses ferrets to study influenza, because ferrets are very similar to us in their ability to contract and pass on influenza. And using ferrets brings with it all sorts of interesting issues, because they're not standardized, for example. Mm-hmm. It's a very small group that work with it. In Australia, another set of issues comes up because, it's a highly biosecure country, very aware, quarantine and so on, because of our native animals in particular. And so which animals researchers can use sometimes is bound by those sorts of restrictions. Looking at uses of native animals, so indigenous animals that are indigenous to Australia. One of my graduate students is looking at ways in which, particularly in psychology, non-traditional models are being used. So everything from sort of marsupial mice to possums, things like this. Looking a fair amount at non-traditional types of mice, because that provides a really interesting set of examples. So there are several researchers here that I've interviewed who work with, different types of mice, which aren't the standardized types. So quite interested in ways in which either the same organism is used for different research questions, or organisms that, on the surface are somewhat similar to the traditional ones are being used in preference to the traditional ones for whatever reasons, practical reasons, reasons that have to do with the conceptual kinds of questions that are being asked, or also due to kind of the adaptations that the animal might evidence. So we're just finishing a paper looking at uses of extreme animals with extreme adaptations as kind of a way into examining sort of general processes. So, so these are the sorts of questions. And I mean, I'm lucky the Australian Research Council gave us this nice grant, the three of us, and allows me to come to the States and go to the UK and do collaborative research and do interviews. It allows me to support graduate students and also permits kind of this broader thinking, I think, because it's a 4-year project where I can, you know, look for people who write interesting things in their articles or on their web pages about their understanding of why they've picked what they picked and what they're doing with them, and then be able to go and probe and have conversations with them about those kinds of conceptual issues. So it's fairly open-ended at this point, but we've been getting really great material, which I think will provide not only lots for us to write on, but hopefully some avenues for other people to start thinking more widely about kind of the range of things that go on in biology. You know, there's, to a certain extent, it's been a little bit narrow because of, you know, the big sort of picture things that are going on in biology, but going into obscure corners of the field where people haven't really paid much attention is fleshing out some really interesting kinds of examples and theories and pathways.
Fantastic. And so, I mean, are you finding in speaking with the researchers that they're thinking deeply about, you know, what is the purpose or what is so special about model organisms in terms of then why they might use a non or more experimental organism?
Often the people who use non-traditional experimental organisms are, and there's a rhetoric in this, and there's even publications in this in biology.
Whoop, I think we lost you. Hold on one moment. Oh, okay, we got you back. Sorry.
So I think increasingly, though, that they're thinking about how they can make the kinds of arguments that they need to make, obviously, in order to get their funding.
Right.
And so where there used to just be sort of a paragraph in every grant that sort of said, we're working on this because this is a model organism and we're contributing to, you know, the broader genomic kind of efforts. People now, you know, and there were always people in parallel to the genome projects, but people now are working at that next level of talking about underlying mechanisms, talking about things that can be generalized, or even in a lot of fields, particularly talking about the uniqueness of the organism as giving us information or knowledge that will be useful for some other purposes. So translation isn't always, you know, a really direct one-way street.
Yeah.
And they are reflecting on that because they have to reflect on it when they write their grants, right?
Sure.
And they have to reflect on it when they convince, you know, their administrators to continue to allow them to run a lab or a field site that may seem a little bit left of center, you know. It's harder for them to make those arguments. But, you know, a lot of those kinds of projects have come up with really important findings. One of my favorite ones, one of my colleagues at Adelaide, you know, was part of sort of the platypus genome project because they were really good at genomic kinds of resources. And the platypus turns out to have some sort of similarities that gives inroads for understanding diabetes. Now, one wouldn't think about that on the surface of a platypus. You know, if you've ever looked or seen a platypus, it's not obviously very homologous to anything, right? I think, you know, some of these things, particularly because of the genomic similarities, but more generally, once you're looking at something, many people start to use it to look at different systems because you have, you know, the organism there to study, or parts of the organism there to study. They're finding some interesting kinds of similarities and ways in to problems that weren't necessarily anticipated. So it's those kinds of things that I think getting beyond, in a sense, genomic sequencing is bringing into labs. Many people are doing genomic sequencing still, and it's still really important, but people are doing yet other things. And microbiome work, for example, is going to prove, I think, to be really quite interesting in these coming years for as an example of kind of a new area that's really flourishing.
Fantastic. So it sounds like there's a lot going on, and especially with these kind of non-model organisms or regardless other kinds of organisms, I guess in, yeah, I mean, to me, this is clear that there's a lot of, would you say there's a lot of work to do on these issues, you know, and I suppose in the particular kinds of questions, like what would you say would are the challenges to understanding model organisms and these kinds of research in biology that either you're working on or you hope to work on in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenges are around coming to deeper understandings of what scientists are actually doing that allow us some insight into kind of where biology is headed, if you see what I mean, how it fits in the bigger picture. Right. I think in particular, this kind of work and lots of types of work, but we really find in this type of work is getting increasingly collaborative and increasingly interdisciplinary. And that's a whole different picture, you know, for us to study. We, you know, obviously interdisciplinarity and collaboration has been around a long time in science, but we're talking about the sheer size of groups, their global nature, and the interdisciplinarity just puts on a whole nother level of complications when you try and see how research is headed. Yeah. I think also the scale of research in terms of time, a lot of these things probably need to be studied longitudinally over quite a long period of time to get a real sense of how they develop. But that's where, you know, at least doing contemporary history where I can look back on where they've come from does give a bit of a window into that sort of transition. I think a lot of people, a lot of the scientists I've talked to most recently are quite worried about funding. And I think it's difficult but not impossible to analyze how much sort of funding structures are affecting the shape and the progress of science. And so Sabina and I have been starting to write about this notion that we're calling repertoires, which a package in a way that surrounds, you know, we would want to claim it surrounds successful research in particular, which we hope that the concept or the framework of repertoires forces philosophers in particular, but more generally science studies type scholars, to think not just about, you know, the conceptual, the theoretical, and so on, but also look at the what we formerly might have just delegated to being practical kinds of issues like the effects of institutional structures, funding, practical kinds of things associated with care for organisms, animal ethics, you know, in that case. But we've kind of designed the repertoires framework to be portable to really any field, and are hoping that opening up that dialogue will cause people to start thinking in these ways and a little bit more broadly about what we understand as the doing of science, which formerly might have just been seen as philosophers as, you know, sociology or history, which is background but not essential, really seeing that this is a lot of what shapes even people's theoretical decisions and epistemic decisions and so on. The package deal, the complexity of the package deal, once you start looking seriously at scientific practice.
Yeah. How broadly do you, or how widely do you think the term and the, or the concept of a repertoire is, can be described in the biological sciences? I mean, is that lot of people are doing? Or is that,
I mean, I think the harder question that we've been wrestling a little bit with is, does this kind of repertoires concept even apply, you know, outside of the sciences? Is it more generally about how people do different kinds of work together? So might it apply, you know, in fields well beyond the scientific fields? And I think, you know, I always hate introducing new jargon, and we wrestle with that for a very long time. You know, we need something that gets us away from paradigm shifts and all these kind of Kuhnian notions, which are tired out. They have been for a very, very long time, as well recognized by many, many people. But we need a new framework that at least forces us to start thinking about both the epistemological, maybe even some of the metaphysical things about the status of the entities you study and so on, but also these, you know, things that were in the past deemed purely social or purely historical or political or economic, and how to get those back in the mix in a way integrally to the practice of science and what we study as philosophers is part of what the repertoires framework is trying to force. So we're trying to force ourselves to do that, and we do think there are other people who are very interested in using it. So that's been very helpful to us in our thinking to see how other people are using it, but also very nice to see people taking it up.
Right. I've seen it used in my particular area in philosophy of psychiatry. Some folks have talked about psychiatric repertoires. But so it's great to see, and I didn't realize it how great a frame or how sort of a sort of comprehensive a framework it is.
I mean, the other part about it is that we pick the word repertoire. A lot of people hate it because they think of it as a static, you know, he learned all of the repertoire from Shakespeare kind of way, that it's a written set of written tests.
But it's a social and sort of dynamic.
It's performative is the big thing. So I think there, you know, we both have some backgrounds in various fine arts. And for the two of us, we really see repertoires as about a lot of what we would have probably called previously tacit knowledge, you know, the skills that are associated with performing a certain set of tasks. And that's why we really favor this notion of repertoire, that's all part of this amalgam, this picture, is that that's the skills and the tacit knowledge and tacit kinds of understandings that are part of the picture when people do science. And so that's why we chose that term rather than something else.
Great. So another aspect of your research we haven't quite mentioned is your work with the ARC on the Linkage Project on hostel stories.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a different thing. So at the University of Adelaide, we have what's called an internship program where undergraduates work with an academic, but also with a community or cultural organization or even a business and industry partner to do some sort of internship that is both academic in a way. They have to produce a report, but also aligns with the interests and the needs of the partner. So I ended up supervising a student who was working with our migration museum, which is right next to the university. We're really fortunate because the university's in the center of town in the cultural district with the art museum and the migration museum and the equivalent to the Natural History Museum all sitting right there next to us. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of flow. And through that relationship, I got to know the curator there, and she was getting ready to do a story or an exhibit around so-called migrant hostels, which were accommodation for new migrants that Australia built and ran basically from right after World War II through the 1990s. And a lot of these, I mean, they housed thousands and thousands of migrants. But most of these locations hadn't been well documented, they hadn't been well studied, but a lot of migrants remembered their time in these settings. So through that, then, the curator, Catherine Manning, and I, and with the support of the museum, History SA, which is the parent organization, the state archives, and then two what you all would call city councils in the area, all went in together on a project. And so some of it was in kind, some of it they put in money. That's how our linkage programs work. And then the ARC, the Australian Research Council, puts in a lot more money. So you can leverage kind of what the community puts in, and the ARC gives you even more. So we won that grant and spent a number of years then documenting, particularly in South Australia, all of those things, the stories of people who went through the hostels and their times in those hostels. Right. And I had I still have one PhD student and one master's student who worked on that project with me. And that's been fantastic because it involved all sorts of oral histories. Mm-hmm. I have had an interest in migration history, particularly through my food research and my own background, you know, as a migrant to Australia, but, you know, as a child of migrants to America. So, you know, these things just repeat. And it's been fantastic, too, for me learning a bit more about, I would say, historiography in particular, and thinking about use of oral histories and rational reconstruction and also becoming au fait with the migrant history kind of literature and approaches. And so particularly with my student who finished recently, Karen Agutter, we've published a whole series of articles looking at everything from racism in former migrants' narratives to understandings of home and place and space. And so these things are often transitory. They were, you know, holding stations, if you will, till people got their own homes.
Yeah.
But in many cases, people stayed for not just 3-6 months, but a couple of years. And that was, you know, Australia's very unique in the scale on which they provided that kind of accommodation. Here in Australia, here in America, people tended to go chain migration. They'd stay with a relative or a friend from the village or whatever and be out in the community immediately. Whereas in Australia, these kinds of lodgings were fairly common. And so that really, it's a different shape of the way in which migrants first experienced the country. And it's, you know, it's in question now. We have detention centers and holding centers and so on still in Australia for new migrants and people who've migrated illegally in particular. And so these things kind of come back around. So we use what we've learned from the historical reflections also to think about policy for the current day.
Wow. Now, that, yeah, you're absolutely right in that. I don't typically, when I think of migrants, I don't typically think of staying in hostels, at least in the Americas. And so I'm sure
we didn't have them here. I mean, there's nothing comparable. Yeah. Because they're not like the internment centers that Japanese immigrants and citizens, you know, were in. They didn't look like that, and they weren't like that. There was a lot more freedom, whatever. But you know, they had their own issues. They were institutions in which people lived. Yeah. You know, they provided care for children, English language teaching, work placement, and so on. They were transitory kind of social services were provided, but they weren't always the nicest places in the world, and they often shaped people's reactions to Australia. And the different immigrant groups were quite diverse. And so, you know, everything from the post-World War II migrants through to, you know, when Eastern Europe started changing, those migrants, and then obviously Southeast Asia during the wars in the 70s, followed by Middle East and so on. So the shifts in kind of who comes very much reflect, you know, changes in world history.
Wow. And so you mentioned sort of the kind of more, I suppose, historical aspects of this is getting to learn or think about the historiography and the use of oral histories. I mean, so mm-hmm. in doing so, you know, what has come about from that? What is, you know, as a, if you were to say, you know, my kind of my result of doing this work has led me to think this.
I've always been a fan of oral history. I've never been as critical of it as a lot of people because I only take it as one point of evidence. You know, I don't take what people, particularly because the first people I interviewed were elite scientists who clearly, you know, had things that they wanted to convince me of or convince whoever to read the transcript. So it's no different. Even when you interview non-elite actors, there's not a huge difference, but it still is part of the story. And particularly in that case, I think I've come to learn more about narratives and the way in which people construct narratives. And then I can understand that when I'm talking to my scientist actors, much more kind of the way in which narratives are packaged is part of the puzzle of understanding where they're coming from and what they want you to know as much as what is actually factual. So it problematizes kind of the factual in some way, but I guess I never really did think, you know, there were absolute facts anyway. A lot of this is about narratives and perception and whatever else, and that's what makes it interesting. People are complex.
Wow. And so it sounds to me, would you say that, you know, your kind of work in this, not exactly specifically, I mean, history and philosophy of science domain, I mean, how is it, you know, is it shaping the way you do HPS work, or is it sort of kind of just an additional project? Like,
shapes each other. I see them as all very interrelated, but, you know, I see, you know, for example, a lot of it is about how people think. I see pretty much everything I study is about how people think about complex things that matter to them, right? And that's one of the basic common threads, you know, in all of my work, be it, you know, what do people think? Why do they eat what they eat? How do they talk about that, and how do they reconcile it with their underlying values? So too, you know, why do scientists do what they do, and how do they reconcile it with their values about what counts as accuracy, validity, novelty, you know, all these things are values. And so there's a strong common thread, even though I think on the surface it seems like I do a million different things. I find constant flow between the projects, which might sound surprising, but you know, I've got a student currently looking at attitudes towards meat consumption, but particularly she's also interested in, one looking at meat consumption, another who's looking at ways in which our attitudes towards animals influence our attitudes towards people. And she's been looking at Australian attitudes towards kangaroo and kangaroo consumption. And so there, you know, very quickly we get to down the line of, you know, are indigenous animals special in any particular way? And so another one of my PhD students is looking at animal ethics, and particularly in relation, among other things, to Australian animals. So that flows back into the organisms project. You know, why might we think that these organisms are good things to use? So that's just one example, but, you know, it's an easy one to explain. With my postdoc, we run a methods group, and we try and find things that are going to be to interest of all my students who run across these projects, and some of whom have yet again, different projects, and we're able to find things that ring chords with all of them. And so that, to me, says that there are underlying threads about, it's about values, it's about ways of thinking, it's about conceptual categories for certain. So there's quite a lot of epistemology, even when I'm doing historical work.
Great. So I imagine, so for future work, it looks like organisms and us, how the living things help us to understand our world is kind of the project of, you know, that you'll be working on for the next several years. Is there anything else on the horizon, or is this going to be the focus?
No, so Organisms in Us is the big one that's sort of more HPS-centered. As I mentioned, a bigger project on cases is something that Mary Morgan and I have been envisioning for some time that I think will become sort of prime in the next little while. We, with a group of colleagues, we've got a project looking at what's called in Australia the social license of agriculture. And so in particular, why is it that agriculture kind of has the status it is, has, and is it going to maintain that moral status in Australia? And where are their points of tension, either around different categories or different kinds of practices? And so that's a grant that's currently under consideration. And then there's a large collaborative project that I've started to get involved in, looking at what's called transformative agriculture again. Uh-huh. But this is with scientists who are looking at sort of biological solutions to current agricultural problems or pressures. So everything from genetic modification to using non-GM kinds of solutions to climate change, crop monitoring, things like this. And for that, there really is an interest, not just in the ethical issues, but the policy issues, and also, again, the more kind of conceptual issues around what people think and when these kinds of technologies result in products, whether they're going to be willing to buy them, eat them, use them, whatever else. And so, yeah, that project's great because it really is a true collaboration with scientist colleagues, both at my university and beyond. So that's been a good opening for me to do additional projects with them. So we've got some smaller things on the boil as a result of the larger project.
Sounds like a lot of great projects. Looking forward to hearing about
always.
Them.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
Yeah, so let me ask the question that I've asked many of my guests. What do you take to be one of the greatest challenges facing philosophers of science today?
I think it is balancing this, you know, this increased attention to science and practice with other sorts of concerns, and in particular, how to pursue, you know, sort of robust work around science and scientific practice without getting sucked in. And I think it's particularly a problem in the States for obvious political reasons, without it getting too sucked into being science apologists, if you will.
Right.
So I think, you know, things are really difficult. It's true, I think, everywhere to a certain extent, increasingly academia certainly, but more generally, anything that's seen as elite is under question for all sorts of reasons. And it's very easy for us to kind of go down the track of being, you know, really pro-science, but I don't necessarily think that's what we're about as philosophers of science. We study philosophy of science with its bumps and warts. And, you know, science is a human endeavor like any other endeavor. We can't make it be more special than it in fact is. That's to be disingenuous. And in fact, that's quite dangerous. If you change public expectations to think scientists never make mistakes or science is always right or whatever else, we really are not doing science or scientists any favors. But it is a tricky domain, I think, because, you know, as soon as those sorts of things become transparent, the public starts to worry. And science hasn't done itself a lot of favors by really adopting a very progressive narrative.
Yeah. I really appreciate this answer. It's saying that it's complex and the balance is going to take some time. In connection with, I suppose, being either an advocate or a spokesperson for science, how do you think philosophers of science should relate?
Well, I tend to do it, you know, much more openly, I would say, and be very forthright about the fact that, you know, science is an iterative process. Science is like other forms of human investigation. It's more systematic, generally.
Sure.
It has more implicit or explicit rules for reasoning, perhaps, than some forms of human endeavors, but that doesn't make it any less humanly driven. And so I like to use some of the historical examples of things that were thought to be true and turned out not to be. Mm-hmm. You know, the usual favorites, like, you know, ulcers. It's a great Australian example. You know, how we understood ulcers, in fact, has changed in their lifetime. It's not just about the bad old days where, you know, we didn't have the right technology or we were somehow blinded because, you know, we didn't want to admit the earth was round or religion got in the way. It's not about those sorts of things. There can be very sort of rational things where we just get it wrong. And undoubtedly, most of what's around us now will be proven to not be right, strictly speaking.
Sure.
But that's not a problem. That's part of the process. And what we need are, you know, much more sort of the sort of internal scrutiny that needs to go on, that scientists engage with each other instead of being scared that if they admit they're wrong or point out someone else is wrong, you know, they're going to lose public support. And it's gotten to a very tricky place, I think, these days. So philosophers, I think, need to participate in those kinds of dialogues. So we tend to call it public engagement in science, which I don't mean purely training people to communicate about their science,
yeah,
but truly thinking about engaging with the public. And in Australia, increasingly now, around involving the public in setting research priorities, involving the public from the beginning, not just handing them a result at the end and hoping they're going to like it. And I think, you know, lots of lessons learned, not just GM, but forms of pharmaceuticals. There's lots of stories where people haven't been that thrilled with the technology that comes out the other end, and scientists have been surprised by that. And to me, that's not surprising at all if you don't actually enlist people from the beginning and listen to what society's priorities are. And given, you know, governments fund a lot of scientific research, you know, there is some responsibility back to the general public. And so that's the way I think about it. We've got a nice new research cluster that I'm running at Adelaide with my scientist colleagues and people from the business school, people from humanities all around the university, looking at different ways in which we can enrich our understandings of public engagement in science and industry engagement in science. So not just seeing industry as somebody who can hand money over and that's dangerous because they're going to sway the research,
sure,
but thinking realistically, given that industry is a partner in many, many research domains, about how you do that in a transparent way, protect intellectual property, bring back benefit, you know, to public, but be aware that industry's in it, obviously, you know, for profit, because that's how industry works. Yeah. And I think that hasn't been a sufficiently developed kind of way of thinking, particularly in philosophy of science. The science and values kind of work gets very close to starting to think in more complex ways about those issues. But mm-hmm. I think even more so, we need to continue to think about industry and public involvement.
Great, great. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for that excellent response, and thank you for giving us a tour of your origin story and your work, and also doing, I think, an excellent job communicating how you've done a variety of various projects and continue to do them. But I'm convinced that there is that through line between your work. I see it.
Thank you. I'm glad I convinced you. Some mornings I wonder, I have to say, but you know, when I've got 8 things on the agenda and
right,
7 different students doing so many different things, but it was enjoyable. Thanks a lot, Nick.
Absolutely. Is there anything you'd like to mention or plug, anything about graduate programs, conferences, et cetera, before we go?
Yeah. I always plug SPSP. Come along, even if you didn't get a paper in. We're in Ghent, Belgium in late June, early July. I'm going to confuse the two things. Mm-hmm. And then Integrated HPS, which I'm also now on the organizing committee for, is in Hanover, Germany, right around the same time. Those are both two really great groups to come along, even if you don't have a paper. Posters, I think, are probably still open. So either of those things I'd love to plug. More generally, PSA-HSS is joint, and that may be the last time for a while that they're joint. So encourage people to come along to that and flow between the two groups.
Right.
I'm a big flower, mm-hmm, and the Cognate Society sessions. So there will be a whole raft of these smaller groups, and you get a bit of a taster about what else is going on in the field.
Yeah, I spoke with Allison Wiley just this week about the meeting or whatnot that the PSA board had, and they talked about having these Cognate sessions that kind of say, hey, look, SPSP, here's something to come along for. So
I would expect SPSP ish, which is the, and the roundtables, so the medicine roundtable and the social science roundtable, mm-hmm, all of them have been invited. Unfortunately, they will all probably be at the same time, but nonetheless, it gives you, you know, choose one and see what it's like. And I think, especially for graduate students, it's a low impact way to just get a sense of what's going on more widely in the field than the explicit programs of the societies might indicate.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, Rachel, again, thank you so much for joining us and taking some time out of the afternoon to chat.
I hope you
have a wonderful time in Pittsburgh. Enjoy Lennox Fest, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.